Mr. Smith, Reel 3. Now, when you moved to Derby about 1949, mm. you mentioned specifically that you became religious. What triggered that off?
Well, basically, I joined a youth club round the corner, and I came across such wonderful people. Wonderful people. And I became very interested in religion.
Which type?
Methodist. And I even became a local preacher for a while later on. But it was the people that I came across, a different type of person, if you like, with so much values in life. You know, I'm not a good preacher, but they just seemed to have all the things that I had never had. The one thing I'd missed, of course, that I've always said, was that background that they'd had. And I went in head first with it, and I took it up.
And it's been a lifelong thing.
Still is. Yeah.
Did it help you?
I'm not religious fanatically, you know.
Did it help you make sense out of what had happened to you? I mean, you know.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's what happened to me, the polio and so forth, is not something I've always been angry about. I've never sat down and shouted, why on earth me? You know, it happened to me, and it gave me a different outlook on life, which has had its own rewards in certain respects. But it's never been something that I've been angry about. It happened to a lot of other people as well. You know, as I say, it had its compensations, a lot of compensations. But then when I took up religion, of course, I could understand these things a bit more, and I became, I suppose in some respects, in some areas, I became something different probably to my brothers in certain respects. I suppose I may have preached a bit, but it was something different, and something I've stuck to ever since.
Was Methodism the family religion? Or
no. No, there was no background of family religion.
Were they CV or...?
Well, they would have put that down, yes. But that's not acting.
What about when the question of... I mean, you'd always been interested in the services, obviously had a bad leg, but yeah. Was it... How did you feel when it really came to it, and you came to the age where you would have been conscripted in 1951?
Well, I went for a medical, and I said, is there no way you can pass me? I can remember saying that. And he said, no way, lad. You know. And I thought, well, I was devastated with this, but I just wanted to have a bite of this wonderful cherry that I'd seen hanging. And so I noticed that I could go into the Merchant Navy with my disability. And so I went in the Merchant Navy, and I did only 6 months, but I went all over the world in the Merchant Navy, but I'd achieved what I set out to do, and that is to go into something very similar. And it was an experience and a half for me. I then came home because, of course, I realised it really wasn't a life for me for the rest of my life. The rest of the life.
So this was about 1951?
That was 1951.
And how did you manage? You went as an ordinary seaman?
I was a galley boy, which means I'm not a bad cook at the moment. Don't tell the wife. But I was a galley boy, and I learnt to scrub, peel 100 weight of potatoes before breakfast and wash all the pots and do a bit of cooking and this, that and the other. I relished travelling all over the world. It was marvellous, you know, and I'd have stopped in if I hadn't seriously seen, that it wasn't there was no future to it. And so I came back out, and I actually went back to Derby and took up where I left off.
Back to upholstery.
Back to upholstery, back to the same firm. I helped to manage the firm by then because I got a business brain.
Was your disability a point in the Merchant Marine? I mean, how did people react to it?
No. I never got any teasing. No one ever said anything derogatory about it or anything like that. Not in front of me, anyway, because I think I tended to let people know that, you know, if they did, then I would take them to task on it. But I can't recall being denigrated in any way because of it.
Now, what about, did the army ever accept in any way, as far as you know, financial or any other help, any responsibility for what had happened to you when fundamentally you were under their care. I mean, you wouldn't have been in the northwest frontier of India but for the army.
Right.
Did they ever take any interest in what had happened to you? Or
I think the first thing to say is I don't know whether they were ever asked to, whether anybody ever said, I certainly have never said it, look, this is because of what you did, you know, you took me to India. I don't think anybody ever challenged them this on this, but certainly I've had no recompense for it, and there's been no recognition in, not that I've asked for it, but I mean, it's, no. There was no, and again, for other people who must have gone abroad and caught diseases, camp followers or whatever, they too probably wouldn't have had any recognition at all.
Do you think they should have done? Perhaps that's a difficult question now because it's a different world.
Right, I mean, yeah. I think today, there's no doubt about it that I think if you'd had a strong MP or someone who wanted you to be compensated in some way, I think you could have got it. The only thing I would say about this, of course, is polio victims have always been taught that, right, you've got what you're left with, and you must get on with it. So you're very self-disciplined in that respect. And you basically don't ask. You don't ask for anybody to help you. And so that may be a barrier to going out. But I think, to answer your question in this way, if it was today and it happened to my son, I would be very much in the forefront of saying, hey, what about it? It has crossed my mind as to whether there would be a legal case for it, you know. But life is too precious to fight legal cases for years and years and years. And we've just seen about the tax thing. Chaps fought for 4 years, you know.
The military pension.
The military pension thing. Yeah.
You've had continuing problems with polio. That's something you wanted to say, was that because it came back.
Well, what happened basically was that I eventually went into my own business, was successful in business. I crept up the ladder and I became my own managing director. I sold out a business. I then became the manager of a factory, a new factory that was opening in Stafford, in Derbyshire. For John Brown Engineering, the people who built the QE2. And I was personally asked to go and take this on. And this was 1967. And I took this job on. And it was quite a task, but certainly well within my capabilities. But suddenly, I started to suffer from depression, fatigue, aches, pains, etc., etc., etc. And the diagnosis was that I was suffering from overwork. And I was treated for normal depression with Valium, Librium, benzodiazepines and what have you. And eventually this got worse and worse and worse until I had to retire at 54. I lost a business, I lost my job, I lost everything. And then after I retired in 1988, I was sat watching the television about 1995, and a well-known polio victim, the writer, a very well-known victim, came on television. He lives in Ceylon. It's the science fiction writer, Clark, Arthur C. Clarke, came on television and he said, I can't leave Singapore because I've got polio syndrome. And I turned to my wife and I said, well, I've had polio all my life and I've never heard of post-polio syndrome. It's 1994. I took it up with the British Polio Fellowship, who I'd never been a member of, and they sent me a pack and a video of post-polio syndrome. And basically what it is when going back to when you have polio in the early days, the body has to recover by regrowing the nervous fibers. Now, they grew in all sorts of fancy divisions to make up for those that had been destroyed whilst having the polio. 30 years later, it's now been discovered, those fibres are dying out through overwork. So all the aches and pains and fatigue and depression came back. Now, 30 years after 1933 is 1967 when I started. And now I'm being treated, or trying to get proper treatment for post-polio syndrome, because it is not quite, so far, it's not quite recognised throughout, although it's recognised by the most senior people. One of the most interesting people who's got it is Lord Snowden. He's got it, you know.
Okay, and finally, just to finish the story, your mother, who's a bit of the hero of this story in many ways, she lived a long life. She was worn down as much as perhaps
she was a tough character. She'd been brought up tough, and the life that she led was a very tough life, as I depicted. She went through quite a lot that other people wouldn't have been able to bear. And of course, traumas that came later on in life and so forth. And then, like all of them, she got older and eventually went into a nursing home in Southsea. And at the age of 92, died peacefully in her bed. And on her death certificate said, reasons for death, old age, nothing more. And it's remarkable to think now what she went through, and all she finished up with dying of is old age. But poignant part to that was my eldest brother, who again is another character, took her ashes, took them to the war memorial on South Sea Front, where the name of Roy and several spent a time there, and took the ashes down to the sea and spread them. So she could be with them.
Thank you very much.